You're listening to The Spear, a podcast about the combat experience from the Modern War Institute at West Point.
More than 100 meters outside the village, you were definitely getting in a firefight.
My first patrol I took, we had a far ambush.
And then it was just a huge explosion.
The primary threat was RKG-3 grenades.
Light machine guns and AK-47s, that kind of thing.
Small arms fire, RPG fire.
Explosively formed penetrators.
Suicide bombs.
And then that's about the time that the third IED went off.
And that's when another grenade comes spinning over the side of the wall.
And it's at that point the IED chain detonates.
There was enemy in the wire.
There's all these Humvees on fire.
It was truly bullets flying from every angle that you could see.
I open the door and look outside, and all I see is muzzle flashes.
There's a guy on top with a 240, and the rounds passed right past his head.
At that point, our instincts kicked in.
One pilot on the controls, the other pilot was using his M4 to engage single-man targets on the ground.
You're shooting at everything.
It was a fight.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of The Spear. I'm your host, Dr. Charlie Faint, and I'm here today with retired Special Forces Officer John Fonts. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
John, thrilled to have you here. You have an amazing backstory. Looking forward to getting into it, especially your experiences as young lieutenant in Iraq and later on as a Special Forces Operational Detachment Alpha Commander. Some really interesting stories to talk through. But before we get there, can you give us a little bit about your background? What's your origin story? What made you join the Army and why did you decide to eventually become Special Forces Officer?
Yeah, well, when I was a young kid, I guess 8 years old, my brother attended West Point, class of 1989. So that was my first exposure. And my parents' families were very heavy on military. They're both from Northwest Ohio. My mom grew up with three brothers who served in World War II, Korean War, and Vietnam. And my dad had four brothers, and three of them served in the Army. So, you know, it was around us. And it was always interesting to me because as growing up, I was never allowed to have a toy gun or anything. And at one point, just a few weeks after probably getting in trouble for having a stick that I was making like a toy gun, my brother had deployed to Persian Gulf. He had, you know, just graduated in 89, so he was in Germany at the time. And we were decorating the house and everything like that. And I finally came together. I'm like, so wait, mom doesn't like guns, but we're decorating for Sean to go to war. And I had some conversations early on. And my parents, of course, were very, very supportive of my brother. They spoke very highly of West Point. I got exposed to it, you know, as a 10, 11-year-old coming out here and visiting my brother. And if anyone's had a chance to be here, anyone who walks on, even a 10-year-old, knows that you're in a special spot. And this place was kind of interesting to me. And as I got older into high school and thought maybe, you know, it was very hard to get into. And for me, I've really been drawn to hard things. It's just a challenge. And, you know, I didn't know if I could get in. I applied. I actually got in very late. I got accepted May 4th, 1997, and our day was June 30th. So I think somebody on a Friday was just like, hey, we need one more. Fonts. Hey, he's gone. I got the nod and, you know, I came. And my parents, at that time, my mom had passed, unfortunately. But my dad was extremely supportive. He, you know, it's interesting. Like, I came home and I got a call at high school. And they said, hey, you have 24 hours because Terry Nichols isn't going. So you must let us know in 24 hours if you want this or not. I was like, ooh. I went home and I...
So did you have a backup plan? You got notified really late.
Oh, yeah. I had a roommate for college. I had to tell him. I'm like, hey, by the way, I'm not going anymore. Yeah. I had already planned on going to college at that point. So I was all kind of set and I was not expecting it. I wasn't like, oh, I'm going to still hold out. Maybe I'll get it. I thought that had passed. But I came home and I was nervous as any kid might be. And I, you know, I said to my dad, like, I've got to make this decision. And he said... You know, I said, well, what do I got to do? And he said, well, remember what you just said. You've got to make this decision. And he'd been supportive the whole time. And I was just like, I can't. I wanted this. And one of the teachers that let me go home that day that I was in class. And he was like, you know, hey, got to go to the office. I came back. I told him I was been offered this thing. He goes, well, go home and think about it. And I said, I don't know what I'm going to do. And he goes, well, why did you apply? And I said, because I wanted to go. And he goes, well, don't forget that when you're making your decision.
What a mature and thoughtful thing to say. And you said the school lets you go home to think about it.
Yes.
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because what a huge burden to put on a young person. That's at least 8 years of your life. You know that there's a likelihood that you're going to go to war because your brother was already there or had already gone, and you decided that you'd go after all.
I did. I did want it. So in the end, it actually was an easy decision. It's just, I think that was the first time in my life that I'd had that much on my decision alone. You know, I had multiple opportunities. I had a couple different universities to choose from. So I was like, okay, I can choose this or that. And I got time to think about it. I'd never had kind of a pressure decision like that. As you said, there was, you're not just committing to, oh, I can change this in a little bit, or it was going to change the trajectory completely of my life. So it was a hard thing to decide. But I do remember those are the things that stuck with me. It's like, you know, why did you apply? I wanted to go. Well, remember that when you're making your decision.
Did you take any preparatory steps between the time that you made your decision and the like 30 days that you had before you reported?
A lot of push-ups, a lot of sit-ups, went for runs. Yeah, I was worried about the physical aspect. I was a cross-country runner, so I was like 5'10", and I think I was 148 pounds. So I was a skinny guy. So knowing that I was going into a school that required you to do PT, I just started going to the gym a lot. Yeah. That was basically it, though. And my brother had given me actually his bugle notes to me. And he's like, you know, if you learn some of these things, it'll help out. I'm like, how is memorizing this little poem or song going to make things easier on me? He's like, just do it. Trust me.
So for our listeners who aren't grads, bugle notes is the collection of knowledge that you need to know when you come to West Point.
Fourth class knowledge. That part of the cadet basic training is passing it off. And it's tied to the history of West Point. It's also tied to leadership as well.
Very good. So you got to West Point. Was it everything that you hoped it would be?
It was not.
So please explain.
So I'll explain by fast forwarding to when I came back as a TAC, and when I would talk to the new cadets as they came in, and I would have a kid stand up and read a letter. And the letter said, "Hi, Dad, you know, hey, everything's going fine here, but this isn't the right thing. You know, please get me an application to Michigan State. I'm going to be coming home, you know, just the right thing. Love, John." And, you know, at that point, everyone just knew me as, you know, Major Fonts. And I was like, all right, so what's my first name? And the first time I did it, no one said anything except for one kid raised their hand. I said, is your name John? I said, yeah, that's my letter. July 4th, 1997, I sent a letter home to my dad that I was done. It's a little bit of a process to leave the academy. And so in those 2 weeks, my squad leader, at the time, Cadet Sean Russell, said, hey, you know, you got to do these certain things, but I also want you to talk to the chaplain. I really like this chaplain. It was a guy named Father Wood. Well, Father Wood wasn't there that day, so that was my time to go and talk. So I talked to Father Greg Sykes. Fast forward again to 2005, Father Sykes would marry my wife and I. But we sat down and we talked, and he really wanted me to give it another 2 weeks. And I said, well, why? And he's like, because I didn't really like the military when I first got into it. You know, I became a priest and then I became into the military. And he's like, and I thought I was going to go back to being a priest, but I just kept going. And he's like, and when you start realizing that people here are relying on you, you want to make sure that's really your decision. You want to leave before you decide to do that. And so I gave another 2 weeks. We did a little bit more activity out in the woods and a little bit more team-oriented stuff. And so I did decide to stay. And did decide to give another 2 weeks and, you know, gave it another 24 years at that point. But
so what was it that you didn't like about this? Is your cadet basic training?
Yeah.
Okay. What was the problem?
As people kind of know, West Point will stress you. It will be demanding. They yell at you, you know, believe it or not. It's not a secret, I don't think. And that is not something I grew up in my life. You know, I was not raised by any means by that. My dad was a very gentle man. So like, I just thought to myself, honestly, I thought, why would I want to be in a place or be on a team where people just yelled at you? And, you know, Father Sykes explained to me, is like, you know, we have a saying, Beast is not West Point. West Point is not the Army. And he kind of explained to me, is like, you want to be able to handle that pressure. And the only way to know that you can is to experience it. And he's like, the pressure is not there to make you feel bad or demean you. It is to be demanding because it is a demanding job and you want that. If you want to be a platoon leader, you want to know that you can handle that kind of pressure. And you got to be able to figure out what matters and what doesn't matter. And I remember a little bit of talking with Father Sykes about that. And even Cadet Russell, who was one of the people yelling at me. But he's like, listen, I'm doing this because you're going to get it. It's going to start clicking. He's like, I got yelled at. You're getting yelled at. Believe it or not, one day you're going to yell at somebody too. And I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm never playing this. And you know, then I turned into a cow and I yelled at people too. But it was very foreign to me. And I just didn't understand exactly how that was the team building aspect. And this wasn't explained to me, you know, coming in. They just like, do this, do that. You know, no reason why. You know, good to ask. You don't say, well, right. How does this apply to being a platoon? No, that's not a question you get to ask. You get to do what you're told. So it was just very foreign. You know, I was away from home. I'm the youngest of four. And I kind of thought, you know, my dad was on his own now too as well. I'm like, maybe I should come home, go to school closer to home. Maybe that'd be better. But no, I stayed. And I think for me, the first semester was hard, decent academically. Not strong. I think I had a 2.5. It's not great. It's not a great GPA. But I had a lot of people helping me out. My roommates were helping me out. And then I went home for Christmas and I saw all my friends. You know, it was great. But then all of a sudden I started missing West Point, believe it or not. I hate to admit it. But I'm like, I was ready to get back here at the end of Christmas break. And at that point, I never looked back.
What were some of the things that attracted you to West Point at that point in your cadet career? You're back home. You're seeing what everyone else is doing, what you could be doing, yet you said that you started to miss West Point. Why?
I started talking about some of the things we were doing, and it was interesting because my friends were like, well, that's weird. You know, we just like, you know, try to go to a party or try to like go work out or like hang out and watch a movie. And I think it was starting to click to me that, you know, there was something bigger happening at West Point that I wanted to be a part of. And it was hard. You know, you talk about having to get up on a Saturday. You know, my friends weren't getting up on a Saturday, cleaning your room. They weren't cleaning the room, you know? And so like, I started to realize that this is a difficult thing. And again, I think there is always something that's been drawn, that has drawn me to doing hard things. And it was hard. And I was like, I'm making it, I can do it.
What kind of things were you into as a cadet? What kind of clubs or activities did you spend your time doing?
I was super interested in scuba diving. My dad was a swim coach, so I loved the water. One of the cadets in my company, Jeff DiMarzio, was like, hey, why don't you come and get your scuba license? I'm like, sounds great. And I got certified at Lake Popolopen when it was snowing. I remember that. But again, it was just this fun kind of atmosphere. I was into running. I ran the Marine Corps Marathon well, it was actually down in DC. I'm like, cool, I could just go see my brother who lived down there. And all I got to do is run a marathon. But I was a high school runner and I'm still a runner. So I did a lot of that. And then that was it, really. I was in the cadet choir, and so there were some trip sections that came with that, which was great to get out of this place. Kept me, you know, every once in a while I got a chance to leave, but that's all I did. The rest of the time, I was just trying to pass physics and hang out with some friends.
One thing I frequently hear from West Point graduates, as well as cadets, is that West Point sets up conditions for you to be able to fail here and learn from those failures. It seems like a lot of people who come here are super high achievers that haven't failed at much in their life, and they have an opportunity to work through that now. Did you have any experiences with failures as a West Point cadet that you think helped shape you into the Special Forces officer that you became?
Yeah, there was two big failures for me at West Point. One was declaring a computer science major. That was the first mistake. My two brothers were into computers. I'm like, hey, computers are kind of new here in 1998 or whatever, and I declared. And it turns out I wasn't very good at computer science. And I'll never forget, Captain Zoller sat me down and AI with some additional instruction, you know, that you can get from your instructors. And he said, Cadet Fonts, these AI sessions are just turning into me reteaching you the class. You should probably consider a different major. I think that was the harshest comment I'd heard from an adult. So like, but he was being honest. He wasn't being
right,
mean.
Right.
And I came back and I was, you know, pouty. And my friend who was in my company, Robin Klein, now Robin Lassen, was like, well, come over to BSNL. It's just a bunch of bullshit and lies. I'm like, you know what? That sounds more like my avenue. And I went over and became a psych major. And, then I ended up going back when I came back for attack and got my master's in org psych from Columbia as part of the program. So it really was a fit. And I really, I just happened to fail into where I needed to be. And the second one was, again, I like to have hard things. And I tried out for CDQC as a yuck. I finished 30 out of 25. I felt pretty good about that. It's a hard course, and I was a yuck. I went back, and I got 15 out of 25 as a cow. Went all the way down to Key West, and on the surface swim, I was 3 minutes too late. You had to do it in 90 minutes. I did it in 93. I got dropped from the course. And I came back, and I had some summer training after that. And the sting of seeing everybody that I knew and saying, like, hey, how was dive school? How was dive school? Like, oh, hey, why aren't you wearing your bubble? It's like, that was a really tough time for me. When I failed that, I went back to my room and I just cried. And Mickey Troggett was one of the guys with me and just came in my room and just stood there for a second. He's like, hey, man, he's like, you can always come back. He's like, I don't care if you have to go back to Special Forces, you could always come back. I got lucky. I got a chance to actually come back after graduation. So I graduated as and became a lieutenant. And the next day I flew back down to dive school. And that time I got it. It did expose me to Special Forces, both my junior and senior year. Rather than spring break, I went down to Campbell Pool, Fort Campbell, and spent the entire spring break doing PT and surface swims. And I fell in love. They took us around the team room. I saw the kind of autonomy they had in Special Forces. And I thought that was pretty cool. And then when I got out to the big army and saw my life in the infantry, I was just waiting to get back and try Special Forces again. But it was a really nice exposure. I'm glad. I know West Point has had dive school on and off as an option. I know it's back. I think that's really great. It really gave me a good feeling that I wanted to go that route.
We have a very strong combat diver program here, as mentioned, and it's actually run out of Modern War Institute. A lot of people don't know that. So Sergeant Smith, who I'll introduce you to right after this episode, does a great job of running that. We have some of the most highly physically developed cadets at West Point go through that program. A very high success rate now, and a lot of them, most of them, go on to a career in special operations. So it doesn't surprise me that you had that interest and you became a Special Forces officer as well.
100%. When I was here, I think I'm trying to remember the numbers, but it was more than 50% had returned to the soft community. And the time I was here, the commandant was General Richard Clark, later a 4-star commander of SOCOM. So he was interested in that program as well. And he was a big proponent of it and expanded even CTLT to some other people as well. When I was here, we sent two females to CTLT with SF teams. So for the first time. So he was
amazing.
A big proponent of that. And one of them was from my company, later a Ranger School graduate. So those kind of things, exposing cadets to it, to give them a little taste of that, and then they know they want more, they're going to go for it.
For sure. Well, last year, Sergeant Smith sent two female cadets to CDQC for the first time, and they graduated.
So I did not know that.
Certainly not the first females to graduate from CDQC, but the first cadets. One of them, Megan Cooper, I worked with for a number of years. She was on the combat weapons team here, and I'm sure she'll be in the soft community shortly, if not already.
She's going to do the same thing I did. She got exposed. She got a taste of it. She's going to want more of it, and I look forward to when she gets there.
Before we turn on the microphones, you and I are talking about your career, and you mentioned you had a pretty exciting experience as a lieutenant. Shortly after getting commissioned, you found yourself going to your basic program and then heading overseas. Can you talk us a little bit about that?
Yep. I reported in August of 2002 to Fort Bragg, Charlie Company, 2nd of 325, after an extended stay in Ranger School. And we went to NTC in October, and so things were very new for me. We did platoon exevals. I mean, I was loving it. It was the life I wanted. Airborne operations at night. And we were on DRF over the holidays. And there was a lot of talk at that time at the end of 02, beginning of 03, of potential buildup in Iraq. When we came back, there was a lot more discussion, a lot more troop movement. And it started to get curious to us, like, is there going to be something for us? Is something going on? And I'll remember, I can't remember the exact day, but I do remember the feeling of when we got called by the company commander as lieutenants, and we walked over to one of the gyms on Fort Bragg, and we walked into the room, and the floor was covered. I'm a giant map, maybe 20 by 60 feet of Baghdad International Airport, just laid out on the ground. And we all just kind of got close to it and realized we're looking at an airport, and it had Baghdad Airport on the top. And we just looked at the company commander, and he goes, that's the objective. And dinner was different that night. You went home and it was interesting. You had to sign some non-disclosure agreements and things like that. It was, you know, you wanted to do that, obviously, but it was the first time that I'd actually been given kind of that information. And I was 22 years old, you know? So I went home and I just thought to myself, like, this trajectory is changing once again. You know, I'm on a new trajectory. Something's going to happen here in the next year of my life and I've got to get ready for it. And we came back and shortly after that, we left for Iraq, and we started out in Saudi Arabia, RR. My battalion commander at the time had served for then Lieutenant Colonel Votel in the Ranger Regiment, and we got attached to the Ranger Regiment there under JSOC in Saudi Arabia. And we were not in country long. I think we showed up the 12th of March, and the war kicked off there at the end. And all of a sudden, you know, we had trained, we were going through the 96-hour sequence, which is a part of the airborne operations airfield seizure sequence. We were into it. We had started it. We had planned on it. But the Thunder Run that was going on went so fast that the troops end up basically, the Iraqi troops basically fell back to buy up and just became super built up and was no longer a feasible objective for an airborne operation. So they said, yep, change it again. Got into an aircraft and landed in Talil and bust up to a Samoa. You know, nowadays you think of people when they go into warfare, maps are prevalent. Google Maps is is your pocket. We didn't have a map of a Samoa. There was a couple maps for the battalion. And I remember we were doing a part where there was three bridges and we had a certain bridge. I ended up drawing the map of the Horseshoe Bend on a piece of paper the best I could about this is a main road coming up. This is where the road goes around. Bridges here, bridges there. And that's all we had as three lieutenants. Wow. We'd be standing at the map and then a major from the battalion would come over and he's like, I need the map. And we'd have to stand back and let him go look at the map. Looks okay. And then we go back and start drawing it again. And we briefed off this piece of paper. So that's all we had.
That's astonishing. It's hard for us to, in 2026, to think that we don't have something simple like maps. But I guess, especially if you're spending all your time planning to go into Baghdad and do that airfield seizure, then your S2 is producing maps for that and yes. Maybe not so much Talil.
Correct. Yep. Yeah. And the maps that they did have even were old. I think they were like from 1974. which was also interesting and shocking. But yeah, you know, you're doing all this. And yeah, we had maps of buy-up. And then someone made a decision based on real-time things happening on the ground. They're like, nope, I need you to secure this. And basically what we were doing is, if those that remember from the time Jessica Lynch had just happened.
Right.
The Thunder Run was going so fast that they bypassed a few hot areas. And those hot areas decided not to attack the Thunder Run. They decided to attack the supply lines, which is a good tactic,
right,
in hindsight. And so we were the ones that were escorting them to reinforce and refuel all the tanks that were heading into Baghdad. So that was the reason that we were in a Samoa. It wasn't a predetermined objective target that probably didn't have maps printed off, but all of a sudden it was. And they got a few out there and here you go. And that was it. And so it was, yeah, we landed in Talil and bust up to just outside of a Samoa. And the next morning we did the brief and took off that night. So we did not have much time to prepare for it. It was, you know, Ranger School prepares you with all those kind of things, to be honest. Like, they give you an objective, like, say, go and figure it out. Like, you have to figure it out on the fly, and we did. And there were some great times and some great actions by a lot of people, and everyone was working together, and it was a lot of questions. I just remember that, like, hey, where's this? Where's that over there? I don't know. I drew a box with something on the map. I don't know. I felt I needed to draw the box, but I don't know what's in the box. So if you see there and you get eyes on it, let me know. I'll put it on my paper map. So, but it was exciting times because we were doing what we came to do. We were doing what we trained to do.
It's interesting that you brought up the Thunder Run, which was the armored maneuver force into Baghdad. I think, as you mentioned, it succeeded so unexpectedly that just kind of overran everybody's plan. I don't think anyone expected it. The Iraqis thought that they would hold. The Americans thought they wouldn't quite get so far. And I do think it was smart maybe not to drop the 82nd on an airfield that was being held by a bunch of Iraqi armor. That's probably smart, yeah, to go, make it go somewhere else. So you also mentioned Jessica Lynch, who is a female American soldier that was captured and held by the Iraqis for a number of days. Did you have a part in trying to track her down? Was your unit involved in any of that after she got captured?
No, we were getting updates on that. It was one of the biggest things in the news. And again, back in that day, you didn't have access to outside news until someone came from somewhere else and said, hey, I was up at headquarters and, you know, she's been rescued. And that's kind of how we found out. We weren't a part of it, but, you know, we never knew. You didn't know as much as you know now on the modern warfare battlefield, I think. You know, we had basically our maps, our mission, and that was it. You know, and we were getting indicators of like, hey, you know, I've heard all sorts of things. Hey, they captured Saddam. Oh, no, they didn't capture Saddam. Oh, they got his son. No, they didn't get his son. He's out of the country. It's about somewhere. Like, it's interesting how, you know, information that flowed back then, you didn't have any way of like getting seven different ways of confirming or denying it. And so you just kind of got it and you never knew where it was coming from and you never knew. And sometimes it wasn't going to cause you to make any action, but you're in the middle of a war. You're trying to figure out what's going on.
Right.
Where is everybody? You know, we're not watching CNN. Everybody else is. I think the Iraqi, you know, the brass and leadership was watching CNN, but we weren't. We didn't have access to it. We're just sitting in a town.
It's interesting that you mentioned General Votel and General Clark. You and I have never met before today, but we have a lot of things in common, and it's just an indicator of how small the Army is. General Clark was the commander of the task force in Afghanistan in my last deployment, and then when I came to West Point as an instructor, he was the commandant here. Yep. And General Votel was the DCG of JSOC when I was there, and he's one of the people that wrote me a letter that got me an instructor job here. And in fact, he was sitting in the seat that you're in right now just a couple of weeks ago for a different podcast interview. Very cool. It's interesting that we overlap in those ways as well.
The Army is small. Finding out how small it is. I just had lunch with a former cadet who's now an instructor.
You're bringing up that next generation. And if I remember correctly, when you introduced me to him, he's a major. So is that making you feel old? Majors aren't young people.
No, but I like to turn it on other people too. I like, there's actually four of my cadets have been TAC officers from my time and another handful that have been instructors. And I remember talking to one a couple years ago, and I started doing some quick math, and I said, "Hey, how old are you?" She said, 31. I said, "When I met you, I was 31. And there was silence on the phone for a little bit. She's like, "Just give me a second, sir." And I was like, "Yeah, so you can kind of tell me I'm old, but don't forget you're aging just like me." So, and my daughter had been born a month after we got here. So a lot of cadets saw this little girl, and now, they see pictures or like, "Yeah, well, Caroline's getting her driving license," or you can see the mass not adding up. Like, if that means she's that old, that means that's how long it's been. Oh, man.
Right. Right. It goes by fast, too.
It does.
Yeah. So you mentioned the DRF, the Division Ready Force, that you were part of as the 82nd. That's a pretty big responsibility. Did you and your soldiers worry that you wouldn't get your chance? Because Afghanistan's already happening, and the frame of reference for the wars prior to that was like 100 hours in the conflict. Was there any concern about that for you and your troops?
If I remember correctly, there was some kind of talk about like, "Hey, I think it's good to be DRF over Christmas and New Year's because probably nothing's going to happen till the new year." Whether that was wishful thinking, we were just trying to tell ourselves, "Don't worry, guys, we won't miss out." But yeah, because you wouldn't be the element that deploys. But then, we just, we're lieutenants, so we know everything. And so we're starting to say like, "Well, wait a minute. If we're coming off DRF, we're the most ready to go unit. So the other guys are going to stay and we're going to go. This is going to be great. It's going to be perfect." Actually, that kind of turned out to be close to what it was. Not at all because of anything we said or knew or didn't know. But it was, I guess, a little bit of timing. Sometimes timing plays a part in that. I got recycled Ranger School. I started a later course. I had a good friend who got to brag earlier, and we were roommates. And in January, end of January, he came in from work, and he's like, "They did it. They took my platoon away. I'm going to be the XO for the invasion." He'd been there 9 months. I'd been there five. He had a full rotation as a platoon leader, and they wanted him as the XO, and he moved out, and I moved in. So, and I was the last lieutenant to show up before we deployed, so I stayed in the longest before I got moved out. So I stayed as a PL until October.
Wow.
So I did 14 months.
That's a long time.
Yes. It's not normal. Again, sometimes you get lucky, sometimes you don't. You can't set up every domino in the order you want them. You have to just try to stay one step ahead as they're falling. And, I have a thing that sits next to my dresser that I used to, especially with the cadets. Things turn out best for those who make the best of the way things turn out.
Yeah.
And that happens. And there's too many different times in my career that if I wouldn't have recycled there, or if I would have gone here, or if I didn't pass, or I, decided not to take that course, it would have been all different. And you can't game life. It's going to come at you. You can set it up. And I'm not saying you don't make all the decisions to try to figure out and make a plan. But as we all know, no plan survives first contact, and same in life, same in careers.
I agree. And I think some of the best things that happened to me in my life happened because I didn't get something I thought I really wanted at the time.
It happens. I try to, 100%. It's happened for me too. And you're like, you almost would have thought like there's that period where like, I want to go back. And all of a sudden you're like, wait a minute, if I go back, then this thing's not going to happen. Then you realize, nope, I'm where I need to be.
Yeah, that doesn't help in the moment, but no, upon reflection down the road, you see where that's branched off. How long was that first deployment with you?
In 11 months.
Wow. Yeah. It's a long time.
11 months and a week, yeah. It was, we didn't expect it. And I remember General Swanson was the commanding general of the 82nd. And he came around near the end, probably like late April. Baghdad had fallen, we'd taken it, and I remember, and I didn't mean any harm by it, but we've learned over time, to be careful about giving people's hopes or anything.
He said,
"Hey, don't worry, we are a liberating force and an occupying force. We're going to be cooking on our back porch by 4th of July.
Hmm.
Yeah, I got home in February of 2004. Made it in time for Valentine's Day, though. But yeah, it was a long time. Again, you didn't have as much contact as you normally did. In fact, we went over and I didn't talk to my girlfriend, now wife, for 3 straight months. Mm. And by the time that I got to make a phone call, you know, when I showed up in back those days, I didn't have a cell phone. I showed up at the 82nd, first day, my company commander was like, what's your cell phone number? I said, I don't have one. He said, get one. I said, okay, today. I'm like, okay. It's like, you will come tomorrow with a cell phone. He's like, we have him here. I'm like, okay. But I got to the line and I got in line to call my girlfriend. I'm like, I don't know her number. So I had to get the guy because we kept a roster for a DRF and,
right,
you know,
right.
And I'm like, hey man, what's my home phone number? And so they gave me the home phone number and I had to call and leave a voicemail, which I don't think she was too pleased about hearing when she got home. So, you know, probably excited to hear my voice, but wondering why I didn't call. And then I said, can you send a letter with your cell phone number? So it took almost another month before I was able to actually call and speak to her.
Oh, wow.
I just didn't even know the number. So I guess I prepared for some things, not everything, before deploying.
It's so different now with this instantaneous communication. I remember when I was a lieutenant, 1998, we did a rotation to Multinational Force and Observer. So we're in Sinai, Egypt. And it was very similar, waiting in line on phones to call back. You get one shot to do it. We had one computer connected to the internet for the entire task force that was dial up. It was ridiculous times. So communication has definitely changed the way that we fight warfare, but also how we deal with the home front while we're gone.
Yeah. Yeah. All for the better, I think.
I think so too.
Yeah.
So what kind of operations were you doing in Tallil? You're there a long time as part of one of the premier units of the United States Army. What kinds of things were you all doing?
We started, but we were on the move. And basically we would go to these areas that were choke points, bridges, and we would secure it, supply lines would come through, and then other units were coming behind us, and we're almost doing like a leapfrog, and we'd go to the next part that we thought was a choke point that potentially the supply lines could get hit. We'd secure it. After the Battle of Assamawa, which was March 31st to April 4th, I believe, after that, we saw a little bit of conflicts, but it was not sustained. So Assamawa was greater than 24-hour kind of thing. Everything else was like 4 hours or less, and the resistance from the forces was dwindling. So we worked our way all the way in through Adiwania, Anajaf, and I got all the different printouts. People were taking screenshots and printing you maps of the city. That was all we had for maps. We did not have the typical map that you saw folded out you're used to having. It was, you know, 8.5 by 11 printouts from computers. And put them in your pocket, go to the next one, get the next one. So I have all of them in a little scrapbook. It's it's a good thing to look at. I do it often. And it does remind me of just how fast the information was coming, how fast you had to process it and make a plan. So again, I credit Ranger School to those kind of things because they give you an objective and they're like, yeah, you're going to hit it in 8 hours. Like, go. Didn't realize at the time how valuable that was going to be for me.
You mentioned the conflict in Samoa.
Yeah.
So can you talk about that? That sounds very interesting. You mentioned it was a 24-hour contact.
Yeah, we landed. And then again, we did a quick turnaround. The next day, we started getting a little bit of information, got access to the map, and had to have a plan. And moved out that same night. There was Task Force 141 had come through. And again, like the stuff was happening so fast. Basically, we're told, listen, you got to go secure these 3 bridges. Alpha, Bravo, and Charlie, you all get one, and you're all going to pass through. And that was kind of how we came up with the plan. Like, Alpha Company is going to be out in front and take the first one, and we'll have contact with Alpha, link up with them, and they'll point Bravo to the next one, and then we'll pass through Alpha, Bravo. What became difficult because we're not used to that kind of terrain. You know, you go to the mountain range here, there's usually like right turns, left turns, you know, there's not big giant garbage humps of hulls of cars or carnage from the war, like, you know, blown up tanks and things like that. One of the bridges that we came to, they had successfully blocked it by blowing up a vehicle that was coming across that was shooting at them. But now it had turned over on its side. And in order to get over, you actually had to climb over this thing. So you're very exposed. It's very hard to get a company across. It was just some of those things that we were just learning on the fly or saying, what do we think we should do? You had to learn to just kind of like ask the room, like, hey guys, who's got an idea? but the American soldier has always been, you know, the ingenuity is great, and it showed a lot there.
You would ask your soldiers for input when you're coming up with a plan?
We all did. We did. Yeah. We couldn't hide it. It wasn't like Ranger School was like, okay, I've got this. People have done this before. There's an answer. I need to come up with the answer. It's just like, I don't know what the answer is. And so guys, like, And we're light infantry. And then pretty soon after that, we're on vehicles. And like, it was like, hey, well, you know, we got to come up with some SOPs. Like, this is not what we do. And so what do we think? You know, what do you think? And like, what do you think about what he thinks? All right, this is what I think. What do y'all think about what I think? So there was a lot of back and forth that went on. And I think everyone saw the value of it and everyone felt they had some input, some buy-in. And involvement led to commitment to what we were doing when we decided that's what we were going to do.
Did you do a lot of that type of thing before you deployed when you were in training? Did you and your platoon sergeant or you alone ask for that type of input?
I have to say no.
Yeah.
We went to NTC, which is a very different terrain. You know, why desert fight, which, you know, can be in Iraq, but we didn't have the mount cities and things like that during the NTC training. So it was a lot more deliberate and it took a lot longer to cover ground. And yes, there's mountains in your way, but you knew they were there. And between that and the mountain, there wasn't anything. I think the biggest surprise we came to is just like the way you think you're going to get to the objective isn't the way you can get there. So where are you going now?
I think that's pretty typical of leadership. And that's kind of the answer I expected because that would have been my answer as well. I think in conditions that we're prepared for, we need to ask for input less because we all kind of know what we're doing. Everyone knows what's going on. But in situations like you're describing, at Ranger School, I imagine there probably wasn't a lot of climbing over blown up tanks on bridges as part of the curriculum. So it's probably great to get that input. And what I found, and it sounds like you found as well, when you have that time and you have that high performing team in there, you get a lot of great ideas and things that you never would have thought of simply by asking, hey guys, what do you think about that? Well, sir, that's a technique, but what if we did this? That's actually a much better idea. Let's go do that.
Yep.
Did you ever feel that that might be undermining your credibility or the guys might think less of you if you're asking for their inputs?
I think initially I had a problem with it. I have to be honest. I'd love to say like, no, I asked for input just like a good leader should. No, I'm the guy in charge. Like I need to be able to lead, right? I need to be able to make a decision. It's kind of like the mantra. What are you going to do, PL?
Right.
Like it doesn't say, who are you going to ask, PL? And so initially I really wanted to come up with some plans by myself. I wanted to take a look at it. And again, sometimes it was just space. Like I couldn't bring my whole platoon to the map. So I had this little bitty map and things like that. So, but it soon became, I mean, my company commander was doing the same thing. He would call us in and say, we got to figure out what we're going to do. What do you guys got for an idea? I'm like, how about this? You know, okay, well, why don't you guys go ask about this? And nothing else is going on. Pulling security and planning. So you might as well pull people in and say, guys, what about this? What do you think? Let's red team it here. What are they going to do? Like, hey, this sounds good, right? Are we happy? Are we good? Because we're all doing this together and the stakes were real. And I think that's what probably changed it for people. Like, hey, listen, you're just trying to keep us alive. Like, we're not trying to get a grade here. We're not trying to pass here. We're not trying to show off here. We're trying to all come back together. So let's all put it in. And once we decide that we're happy with it, I've made a decision and I got your input. And they felt like they were able to give input. And we were on the same page and move out, draw fire, as we say.
Does anything else stand out to you about your deployment that first time in Talil?
When my company commander changed out, I had a new company commander came in, Ken Burgess, and at that point we had settled down. This was, you know, past summertime. There was a little bit of IED starting to come up and things like that. And so we were basically doing patrols. We'd go out and watch some of the girls' schools. We put security on there. And I'll never forget when one time he called me in and he said, hey, I'm going to start coming on all your patrols. I'm like, oh, okay. And he goes, how do you think about that? I'm like, I don't like it. I can do it. And he goes, how many times have you not gone on patrol? At that time, it was 60 days in a row. I hadn't skipped one. And he said, yeah, your squad leaders might think the same too. Why don't you consider that? And I was like, oh, okay. In my mind, the right thing to do was to be like, hey, I got to lead from the front. I got to do these things. I've got to be on patrol. But they're not going to be developing out there if every time they're out there, they're saying, all right, hey, PL, what about this? What about that? Like, they needed that opportunity. They'd been in country for 4 months now. They were some of the most combat seasoned people the U.S. Army had. And his point was, you know, part of leadership is development. So if you think that you're sitting here, and I would, you know, of course, like anybody else would talk about, I got the best squad leaders. He goes, well then let them be squad leaders. Let them lead their squads.
That is such an interesting point because here at West Point, and I did RTC, certainly there as well, we're always taught lead from the front, especially as infantry platoon leaders. But what an interesting take and accurate take say, hey, sometimes you don't need to be out there doing it. Go do officer things somewhere else and let your troops that you trust, that you train, that you know are high performers, go out and do it. Did that work okay when you switched into that?
It worked wonderfully, right? And, you know, I don't know, maybe it was his idea, maybe someone had said something, who knows? But I do remember when they rolled out that first time without me, I stood at the gate. And as he rolled by, the squad leader's truck was up in the front, the platoon sergeant was going with him. So he stopped the truck and he leaned out the window and he goes, you okay? I said, yeah, I'm okay. He's like, you don't look okay. You look like you want to hop on. I'm like, I do. And he goes, but you're not. I'm like, but I'm not. And so he's like, we'll be back soon. And I said, all right, man, I'll see you when you get back. So, and I think they became more committed to helping me understand the situation because the only way I was getting information from that patrol was their debrief. Before it was like, well, I was there, so I don't really need to hear everything from it. But they come back like, hey, sir, this went on, that went on. We talked to this person. By the way, we ran into this. I don't know what this is, but it looked weird. And so now they're helping me populate the map of where we should be looking and giving our attention to. So again, a lot of it, you know, I think I've said it a couple times now, like involvement leads to commitment. So yep. These guys were now more committed to what we were doing there. And it worked out just great. And it was an eye-opening experience for me. And then pretty soon I just started going one out of every three.
That makes sense. So you can see how they're performing in combat, and also you can show them that you're not afraid to patrol. I think that's super important also.
Yeah, it is.
Okay. Eventually you decided you'd try out for Special Forces. Can you talk to us a little bit about why you made that decision and then talk about what your earlier experiences as a Special Forces officer were like?
Yes. Dive school had a big influence. It really did. And when I was in country in 2003, you know, there was some Special Forces teams operating. It always looked like they were doing some cool stuff. Again, I was at RR, Saudi Arabia, so JSOC was there. And, you know, so there were a lot of people that were really skilled. And I'm looking at that community and I just thought, I like that. I remember my my company commander was like, you want to be a team leader of 12 and not a commander of like 130 like me? He's like, look at the firepower I have. And me personally, I work better with a small group. I knew that. I've always been that way. I work better when I know everyone around me. And the mission of the Special Forces and I to build up another force, I thought was super relevant to what we were doing at that time. And I'm like, the Special Forces mission is going to be critical and I want in. And so I want to try out for it. And I did. I never wavered on that. I really didn't. Like, I loved my time in the infantry. I'm so glad I did it. I'm so glad I went to the 82nd. But the next step for me was definitely to be a team leader.
Earlier when we were talking, you mentioned working with Afghan Commandos, which is an elite unit in what was then the Afghan military. Can you talk a little bit about what that looked like and what kind of things you did partner with that organization?
Yes, we were with, there was 6 Commando Candex at the time of 2009. I got the one in RC East, the P2K area. And there was a lot of them. There was 3 battalions. And that is not what my guys had been used to. It was my first deployment with Special Forces, but everybody else on my team, except for a couple other people that showed up with me, were on either 2 or 3. So they were more used to getting a partner force, staying with them the whole time, and that was it. We had this cycle where one was on leave, one was on training back at Gardez, and one was on operations in Khoust. And one of the most interesting things that happened is when I showed up, we were supposed to be partnering with the National Guard team. The commander of 3rd group decided to rearrange some things. And he said, oh, by the way, I'm splitting your team. Now, doctrinally, he's correct. And SF team should be able to operate split. I didn't like it at all. And he's like, do you have a problem? I said, no, I don't have a problem. I just don't like it. But so he said, you got to split between Gardez, the training, and the operations. So normally when we would have 12, I actually had 13 on my team. We were just plussed up a little bit. And I had to split them. So it was a tough thing for me. Like, who am I sending to training and who am I keeping on ops? So, you know, doctrinally, I put my warrant over there on the training side of the house and I put, you know, just what I thought was the minimum required force. So I only put 4 guys over there and kept 9 on operations. It was tough. 2 of the people, one guy was okay with it. It was his 3rd trip. And he's like, I got it. Like, I like training people. I do. That's why I came SF. The other 2 weren't happy with me. And so here we are, like, we were talking week 1. We've been training, we're ready to go to be a team. And one of the first decisions I had to do was tell 2 guys, you're going to go sit there and do that. We eventually worked it out where we rotated them in. I was a little bit skeptical at first of doing that. I didn't want to move people around just to move them. I wanted the continuity. I wanted the consistency with the commandos. But so I sent 4 people away and there was 9 of us. And we had a Air Force JTAC with us. And we did a lot of missions. They were supposed to be specially trained. And you know, they performed well. I will say that. Like, even my guys were like, these are people, they've been given some extra training, and that's really nice. They were ready to go. They were loving the missions. They were not from the area, which made it a little bit easier for an Afghan. They were up in the Badakhshan region, so they were far from home. So people were not recognizing them. They weren't trying to figure out who these people were, because people would threaten families and stuff of those who were working with the Americans. We did a couple missions. We did some level two missions, which at that time there was a thing of Karzai had 10 points. And if two of them were red, it was considered a level two, and you had to get clearance from the DCO. And one of them was a nighttime operation, which we like to own the night, as we say, so we're always doing that. And the intent was either to kill or capture. So most of the things we were doing had to be briefed all the way up. And it was also very interesting. I was in Khoust. I was very far, because third group was in the south. I was the only third group team out there in RC East. I never saw my company commander. I talked to my battalion commander once. So that was a big thing that I craved, and Special Forces will offer you, is you don't have a major looking over you. You don't have a battalion commander looking down and say, hey, what you doing? You know, you're not part of that. So you're not integrated. You are all on your own. And I loved it. I want the autonomy. We were pretty busy. I mean, we were integrated with the conventional forces that were there. We had to work with Task Force Attack, the aviation unit. They were supporting us. We were with one of the 25th Division out of Alaska. You know, we're in their battle space. That's one of the interesting things about being Special Forces, is you don't own battle space. So I think one of the most interesting parts of being a deployed ODA commander is those relationships you're building with the conventional forces, because you're operating in that area. And if I do go in at night and take somebody up and remove them, the mess that's left behind is typically left to the conventional forces. So you have to go in and try to convince the colonel that we need to do this operation, and here's why. So it elevated quickly. You know, I had not really briefed O6s on what my operation was, except for in training. But this, again, this is real stakes, real things, and they were very hard on me. You know, I kind of assumed, like, you know, this is, I'm being told I need to go do this mission. I thought initially I'll be going in, like, hey, this is the mission I got, we're going to do it. And I found myself, you know, kind of on my back heels trying to explain to them, like, no, we need to do this, and here's why. I didn't have it very good early on. I had not enough information. And so he correctly pushed back on me and said, you need to come with a little bit more. And so I would go back and came better prepared to brief on him, and had a good working relationship by the end. We were there for 7 months. It got extended a little bit with the Dust One with Bo Bergdahl, who walked off Firebase 4 days before we were supposed to leave.
Wow.
So that changed things for us. So we were working closely with his battalion, and spent 12 days searching for him, clearing, pretty busy. You know, you typically at the end are kind of winding down and doing a handover to the next unit. One, that unit was at Khoust, and I wasn't there to do a handover with them, which was a frustrating thing for them, I'm sure. And we had to just send word back, like, oh, by the way, we're not landing in 100 hours. I don't know when we're coming. And so families were, you know, given some information maybe they weren't expecting or hoping for, and we all had to go out there and do that. So it was just one of the other things, like, yeah, all right, you know, if you're supposed to be a flexible, adaptable force, you know, here's your chance to show it. So
you mentioned the P2K region. If memory serves, that's Paktika and Khoust provinces in Afghanistan.
Yep.
And that's right along the border with Pakistan.
Correct.
So one of the most restive areas of the war was
the Haqqani network was huge in that area. Yes.
Oh, we were chasing Haqqani for years over there. Yeah, they were very good. It's kind of,
yes,
like
they were.
The Delta Force of the Taliban were the Haqqanis. And you also mentioned the Dust One, duty status whereabouts unknown, also known as MIA, Bo Bergdahl, which turned out was being held by the Haqqanis. How did that complicate your operations and your plans when you were in there? How did that affect what you were doing?
Well, you have to keep in mind, at the time, we had very little information about his disappearance. You know, we went and met with his platoon leader. They kind of explained to him, you know, like, he was an odd fit for the unit, and he had spent some time down at the front gate hanging out with some of the Afghans. And so it was very understood at that point that most likely someone that knew that he liked to go down to the front gate and hang just gave him over. And he is, you know, someone that just got nabbed in the middle of the night. And so we were working very hard to try to find this guy and shut down. And so we were sitting on the border, which they don't have signs out there. So you got to be very careful about where you are. And so that was one of the biggest things. It was kind of a running joke, because we have a sense of humor like that sometimes in war, and say, like, you know, someone would hop from one peak on the ridge to the other one. I'm like, wait, am I in Pakistan now or not? Because, you know, we're trying to figure out, you know, if we're even close or we're pushing it, guys, like, this can be a problem. You know, these are not well-defined borders over here. And if someone decides that you're in Pakistan, they're not going to come in and let you know, I'm sorry, you need to go to the other ridge. So that was it was kind of a confusing time. And then we would just go out and we'd search an area or sit on a hill, and then they would come and say, hey, now I need to go look at this village. Like, we think you might be here, and we need you to lock down here. And actually, it was really frustrating because the Afghan commandos, one of the things that they had been told is that they were only going to do these high-level missions with special forces. We usually had great air coverage, all these kind of things. Now they felt like they were being treated like regular soldiers, and they did not like it. They didn't want to be there. So that was an unforeseen complication to it. We're trying to get these guys, because at that point, I think seven, because two guys are already taken off.
Right.
And so there's seven of us and 130 commandos that they're like, no, this is not what we signed up for. We don't want to do this. And it became a very difficult thing to just kind of, and you have no idea where the end in sight. We were not told you guys are going out there for 6 days, 8 days. It ended up being 12 days. We were not told that ahead of time. So on, you know, I think it wasn't until like day 10 did we even kind of have an indication that, okay, we're going to be moving you out, get you back. The other guys are in. And everybody came back and left. And I'm like, I am not leaving without doing a handover. So we were back in the middle of July and everyone else on my team took off in the last 2 weeks. It was just me hanging out with the team that replaced me. And so then I finally got my way back home. But that complication with the Afghans not wanting to be there was a very difficult thing because you can only try to influence people so often.
Right.
I have nothing else to offer them. Like, we're just sitting on a hilltop. We're clearing a village. One time we got told to clear the village again because they thought like we maybe missed them. And it wasn't close to mutiny by any means, but like people were starting to get frustrated. Frustration was growing, and each passing day we're like, all right, he's probably out of here. He really is. We probably missed him. And so trying to motivate people when they don't want to be there, they were supposed to be home yesterday, was a leadership challenge.
Green on blue attacks are when a partner force attacks U.S. forces unexpectedly. Was that ever a concern for you with the Afghan commandos, especially during this time where morale wasn't at its highest?
It was persistent the whole time, I think, regardless of the animosity of the mission at the end. The idea that they would like to have someone on the inside is always a real threat. And so it is a difficult thing. You want to build trust with someone. The Afghan commander, the three that I had were very good. It was one of those things, they'd always want to know more about the mission and constantly trying to tell them, like, and they would say to you, like, hey, we have been working with you for a month now, man. Hey, 2 months. Hey, 3 months. Like, trust me a little bit. You know, it was tough. And I had to tell them, like, hey, when I came here day one, it was, I'm going to keep you safe and keep me safe. So I'm not going to say anything to you that might somebody else pick up. And that's why I don't tell you. Whether he bought it or not, I don't know. That's all I had for him, though. But I think he knew that I was at least willing to talk to him about it. And I think he respected the fact that I wasn't supposed to. But I would try to do everything else I could with him. I'd sit and have tea with him all the time or have dinner with him, learn how to play a card game and things like that. So there's other ways to interact with him. But we were always worried about that. Like, you know, you had to be very careful about what you were saying, who you were saying it to, what you were posted in their operations area, you know, and it gets you on edge sometimes. There was one guy sometime had really cut himself really bad, and he came into our talk, which he's not supposed to be in there. And when they come in, and he's got a bleeding hand, and, you know, just as the medic is looking at his hand, you can see him. He's like, oh, I've never been in here. And so his curiosity is peaking, and he's looking around, and it's like, these are things he's not supposed to see. And that put a lot of people on edge. They're like, watch out for this guy. Turns out, you know, as far as I know, he never had anything malicious behind that. He was just a curious kid who wanted to see the doctor because he just sliced his hand. But, you know, that's, you know, it even got my guys on edge. I'm like, all right, so what do we want to do about it? Like, how can we do this? How can we mitigate this? What are some things we have at our disposal to maybe, you know, keep a better OPSEC or be a little more concerned this next operation? But it was just one of those constant things that was nagging you in the back of the head. Like, it was better to believe that somebody in that group was malicious and trying to get information. That way you treated everybody like that. And again, it wasn't the nicest thing to do, but I think the Afghan commandos understood.
Speaking of building trust, you mentioned that you had to have a relationship with the commanders, the conventional forces that you and your team interacted with. What does that look like? Because I spent a lot of time in the special operations community as well, and sometimes there's a lot of mistrust.
Yes. The colonel was a very smart guy. He loved having us in there. Actually, it was his staff, because I think anytime there was something that we did, they were the ones that had to like clean up with it. They weren't overly enthusiastic about what we were doing, not because they didn't think we were doing good things, but they had their own mission. Now they're cutting resources away. Now they're monitoring different things. Now we needed them on QRF. So I don't know exactly how they felt. We worked well together. I wouldn't say great, They didn't get excited when I came in, and I got a really cool mission, guys. They'd come in, and you could just tell in their face, they're like, this is not something I want to hear right now. I've got something else going on. I wasn't sitting around all day hoping the SF guy would come in here and ask for my helicopters. So it was a professional relationship, but I don't think it was, you know, extremely warm.
After the Army, at some point you got involved in service activities. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about Team Red, White, and Blue. That's something you're in now after service. Can you explain what that is, what your role is, and how that relates to your military service and how it helps veterans?
Absolutely. Yes. Mike Irwin was my S2 in third group, and then we were both stationed here at West Point at the same time when he founded Team Red, White, and Blue. We lived next door to each other. And he's like, hey, I got this veteran organization, and, you know, it's a volunteer thing. We're going to get out. We're going to do some physical activity. You know, one of his first things he would say is, you know, physical fitness is the most underprescribed medication. And I was a runner. I knew exactly how good a long run felt. I'm like, okay, let's do this. I became a volunteer. I left West Point. My wife and I started a chapter in the Sandhills down there in over by McCall in Fort Bragg, North Carolina area. And then when I got out, you know, Mike had talked to me about potentially coming over and doing that. I was also setting up a job to be a contractor for NATO, so I didn't have a lot of time. I got a part-time job doing special events, partnering with like local races and in 5Ks and 10Ks and working out the details of getting some runners out there, getting some money from it. Then I also managed the Soaring Eagles program, which is people get charity bibs for some of the big races, Berlin, New York City, things like that. So I've been doing that. I've been a volunteer. We're now in our 15th year, and I've been an employee now for 4 years. When we're in the service, and, you know, as you've heard, people have heard this conversation about all that was going on as a young lieutenant in Iraq and the stress of trying to figure out what's going on without a map. You know, you're in Afghanistan, or there's someone in there who's a bad guy. We got to do missions with these guys. Our mission is to train these guys, so we got to build them up. We're actually making them better. You know, that mission mindset that we see, no fail, make mission at any cost. People will do what it takes to achieve it. We will sacrifice our own personal health and wellness. We can laugh about it a little bit, but there's some truth to it. Like, you would be on a mission and you'd come back and you're like, I got to get some sleep. You might take a melatonin. Then you got to get up. I got to drink some coffee. And then it's like, hey, we're doing some planning. Like, we're getting ready to go to mission at night. I'm going to drink some more coffee. Do a rip it. You know, those are the big things back when I was there in 09. Like, you know, people would literally stand outside the vehicle and say, rip it, and just open it up, down a rip it and get in and let's go. And then come back, you got to go back to sleep again. And this cycle can be hard to break sometimes.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get out of the military, you got a new job. And as I transitioned out, Team Red, White, and Blue has always been very focused on the transition. Nobody plans to have a bad transition. But usually when things go wrong for a veteran post-service, it's the result of that bad transition. And we're taking a look at that. And we're like, we've got to let people know that, you know, transition means a change. You know, can't just run yourself to the ground, but we're that guy. And America, you know, has supported veterans fantastically throughout the GWAT. And so you don't want to let them down.
Right.
You don't want to be the guy who comes to a new company, whether, I don't care if you transition to be a teacher, you transition to be a salesman or a stockbroker or whatever it may be. Like, you have this belief that as a veteran, a combat veteran or a Green Beret or a West Point graduate, I have this thing to live up to. And I will sacrifice my physical, personal well-being to make that mission. And now I don't have time for PT. You know, in the military, like, hey, that's how, it's just the culture. But out there, it's like, no, I can't make it to the gym today. I've got to work a little bit later. Like, oh, I got to spend time with my kids. I've been gone a lot. I'm not going to work out there. Like, I got to go to bed, but I got to get up early. And so I'm going to, you know, take a little, whatever it might be. It might take a Tylenol PM so I can get some sleep. Then you get up in the morning and, all right, no rip-its. Okay, let's have some, you know, 5-hour energy or whatever it may be. And this cycle is kind of hard to break, and we can wear ourselves down. And so Team Red, White, Blue is there to remind people about that, face that, and remind them that the community is still there. The veterans are still there. The community, the civilians are ready to support you and be helpful to your transition, and that your best days really are ahead of you. And that's a hard thing, I think, for some people to comprehend. Like, no, I'm going to make mission now, this mission. No, you've got to play the long game now, okay? You're raising kids. You're reunited with a wife and spouse, and you've got to give that attention just like anything else. Any other kind of training you got to go through, you got to work on it. You got to rework on it. You got to recalibrate. You got to retest, all those kind of things. It's the same thing in our personal lives. We've got to pay attention to it. And Team Red, White, and Blue is there to remind people to do exactly that. And when you're around other people that say the same thing I'm saying now, it becomes easier to embrace.
John, I'd like to follow up with something you mentioned about this NATO training gig that you've got.
Yes. Boy,
that sounds amazing. Can you, in a few minutes that we have left, can you describe what that's all about?
My last 4 years, I was at NATO Special Operations Headquarters, now SOFCOM, in Mons, Belgium. I was the director of exercises and evaluations. So we would go and help train senior staff computer animated. We'd put injects into it. Hey, there was a white shipping commercial vessel has a dirty bomb. Okay, do we use Special Forces Maritime Task Group, you know, to do an opposed boarding? And so the staff runs through the processes. But I got some really amazing opportunities while I was there to go to 11 different countries, went to Ukraine twice working with their special operations. And I did that for 4 years. And when I got out of the military, you know, the guy who I had been using as my contractor called me and he said, what about joining our team? I said, oh, wow, I never thought about that. But, you know, so you're always doing a job, you know, you're applying for your next job a lot of times by your behavior in your current job. You're always being assessed, as we say, and it's very true. And so I took this. And so I go to Europe about 12 weeks a year, sit in a bunker and basically make problems for a staff to solve. But what I've noticed now on this side is for those 4 years, there was a lot of just, there was a GWAT mindset, Afghanistan mindset. People had done the mission in Afghanistan. So everything was a surgical strike type thing for special operations. And what I've seen now is as the war has changed in Ukraine and Russia, I don't recall my early days injects, meaning these things that we send into the training audience as a problem to solve. I don't remember recall one about a drone.
Right.
Not one.
Right.
Now I can't get away from them every day that I'm over there. That is what the injects are becoming. It's becoming very relevant. We're trying to stay relevant to what's going on and prepare for the next, you know, next war that NATO might be involved in or next mission that they might be involved in. And I remember reading, like, we can read some things, you know, you can see some things on the, even on the unclassed side about 17,000 drones have been destroyed by Ukraine. That's an astonishing number. 17,000. They're cheaply made. They can be trained to have an operator rather quickly. Doesn't put the human life at risk. So if you can manufacture them, you can play the very long game. You can get rid of 17,000 and it's not a big deal. But they're becoming extremely dangerous. And yeah, they can deliver an explosive very close to somebody else. And they can also, you know, cause a lot of havoc just by being present. They don't have to blow up. If we were outside right now and drones started flying overhead and no one in 3 days from now could explain what happened, it would be... Yeah, the superintendent would be being briefed on it probably.
Oh, very disconcerting.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
And the news would be covering it. And so that kind of warfare is what we're trying to figure out. Like, how do we combat it? Like, how do we deal with it? How do we identify it? And what actions do you take? So it's been, I've never seen something change. I've never been a part of, you know, a job where I, because it's, you know, I'll operate at a NATO secret level. So when I'm home in the month and a half in between, I don't get to get all that stuff.
Right.
I show up and I have to read for the first 1 or 2 days of like, what's going on? What's happening? Like, oh my gosh, they're doing that with these things now? It's that size? It has that kind of distance? I mean, the it's rapidly changing over. And I think it's just something that everyone needs to be aware of. And those that are wearing the uniform should pay close attention to.
I appreciate you bringing that up. Before the show, we were talking about some recent developments here at MWI. We produced the Ukraine papers and the autonomy papers. Anyone interested in finding out more about what John's talking about should check those out on our site. So John, we're coming in into the of our time together, but I wanted to give you the opportunity to have the last word. Anything else that you think is relevant? Any final words of advice that you might have for the young leaders listening to the Spear today?
Yeah, thanks for that opportunity. Being here back at West Point, seeing some of my former cadets, now all grown up, majors themselves. I was a major when I was here. You know, sometimes when you get an opportunity like this, and again, thank you so much for the opportunity. You know, I think it's good sometimes to highlight maybe something you didn't do so well. You know, kind of let the next group of people understand what they can do better. And I would say, don't underestimate counseling. You know, it's one of those things that you see here at West Point. You know, we talk, we do counseling and things like that. You get out in the Army, and sometimes you like to play what maybe the big boy rules. I don't have to sit there on a piece of paper and tell you exactly what I want to do or things like that. Don't underestimate the value of doing that. When you're a young leader or a senior leader, I don't care, and something isn't going the way that you think is helping your unit, it doesn't get better with time. So take the opportunity and sit someone down. Perhaps the biggest mistake I had is during the time with the Afghan commandos, a mission where you're supposed to train them, put them in front. I had one individual who was more aggressive. He had come from B-23, you know, a very direct action type unit, and he wanted to do it himself a little bit or get it done. And I would say, no, don't do that. And he'd get upset. And rather than sit him down and saying like, all right, I said no, you did it again. Like, you sign right here acknowledging that you weren't supposed to, and you did. I think that might have made it, we might have had to part ways cordially at that point, but because of that, it got to the point where we had to part ways not cordially, and it required me moving him off the team, and that's during a deployment. That's not the right thing. That's not the leader setting up the unit for the best. So I know it sounds trivial at some times. It is not. It is a leader action. You sit down face-to-face with your people, sit them across the table, let them talk, put it all down on the piece of paper. What do you think about this? Write it down, come to an agreement, and walk away and have a date where you're going to come back and look at it. Some people might find it ridiculous. I don't need to worry as much about those people because they're not the ones that are dedicated to working with me, working with you as a leader, saying, okay, you want to talk about it? Let's talk about it. Let's put it down on paper. Let's put it down on paper. When I would do that later on, again, people would see, okay, I said I was going to do that and then I didn't do it. I got some ownership of this problem now and it's clear. So there's some clarity provided by counseling. Don't underestimate it. Don't think that just because you have a great relationship with your platoon sergeant or your first sergeant, that it's not necessary. It is.
I think that's a great point, and that's something I try to bring home to the cadets here as well. If you don't write it down, it never happened. And a lot of people think that it's some type of negative reflection on their leadership if they don't write counseling down, but it's not. It's useful for two ways. First of all, if there's a pattern of misbehavior, it's not the first time when you bring it to commander. But also, if you're doing counseling regularly, then it's a lot easier for you to substantiate good things. Hey, the commander's got some waivers for E4. Who are we going to give them to? Well, here's why you should give it to my guy. Or at the end of the tour, or when it's time to PCS, here's why you should give this person this award that you normally wouldn't. I've got all the paperwork for right here.
Great point.
John, thank you so much for this conversation today about warfare, overcoming failure, and forging a life after service. On behalf of our director, Colonel Pat Sullivan, I'd like to present you with this rare and coveted MWI coin. Appreciate it, brother. Thank you.
It looks great. I appreciate it. This has been a really great experience for me. I'm so glad that you let me do it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Spear. The Spear is produced by the Modern War Institute at West Point. What you hear in each episode are the views of the participants and don't represent the position of West Point, the Army, or the U.S. government. Be sure you're subscribed to The Spear on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app, where you can also give the podcast a rating or leave a review, which helps us reach new listeners. And if you aren't yet following MWI on social media, please find us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Thanks again for listening.